This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Hello, Catherine.
Hi, Kate.
What are we going to talk about this week?
Okay, this week we're talking about the editing process, which I have just finished.
Woohoo!
Yes, the freedom. The freedom. May I never see that book again, except in stores.
Obviously, and in your hot little hands.
Exactly. But we'll start with Skylarking, because I think what is interesting about Skylarking, your origin story, is you actually only had part of a manuscript when you signed your contract.
It's true. It's true. I only had part of it. And I know that on another week, we're going to talk about how we come to tell our own tales and our origin stories, because I wanted to check on this fact of how much I actually sent to Aviva when I first sent it. So I pitched the concept. I sent my editor, or my soon-to-be editor, Aviva Tuffield, 10,000 words. She asked for more. She asked me to send everything I had. And I actually had 60,000 words. I've always said I think I had 40,000 words, but I checked the email trail and went back with fluttering heart to look at that first email that I sent her. And it was 60,000 words. It was a mess.
Yep.
It had, you know, kind of 10,000 words at the end, like this scene goes here, or I think this is a scene.
Yep.
But it had chapter outlines and I'd written through to the end. But it was nothing like we would be told in writing courses or from agents what we need to submit as a manuscript. It was a horrible mess.
And so percentage, this is a very germane question, but percentage difference between, like, even though it was in a mess, the actual writing itself, because I can even remember having seen scenes in writers' group that did end up in the manuscript pretty similar to what they had been.
Yeah, so there were some chapters like the first one I ever wrote, and maybe people all find this, which isn't like it's chapter 10 in the book, but it was the first thing I ever wrote that has kind of pretty much stayed the same. And I think some scenes and some chapters, you would have this experience too. They just have an energy about them that they stay like that. There was also maybe 40,000 words that never made it, like whole backstories for particular characters, other chapters that I tried and then lost. Certainly having an editor on board at that early stage, I actually think it meant I didn't have to do so much of the processing work myself, because instead of having to work out, oh, this scene isn't working, I would put the scene up, Aviva would say, that is not working, and it would be gone.
So that's fascinating. So it was a much more collaborative process in that.
The structural edit occurred before I had done a structural edit myself.
Yep.
I suppose. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So from there, I suppose it just went more fluidly. Whereas now, you know, I'm trying to make a polished manuscript, I suppose, to get to someone. It's an entirely different experience. What about for you?
So mine was probably atypical in some ways as well. So I had a manuscript that I gave to text, to kick off the structural editing process. Mandy and I went to lunch at Maha. It was very nice.
Of course.
but basically we just had a discussion and she said, you know, these are the things I think need to change that you need to work on. And then I went away after that. You know, she didn't give me any notes or anything. It was purely the discussion. I made changes across about a 3-month period. And then went back to Mandy. And then we had this really quick process to get it from that point into a bound proof. So it was very much, this is not perfect, but we'll polish it up, put it in a bound proof, distribute that. And then I sort of had this second structural edit where I had input from overseas people as well as Mandy. I probably had input from 5 or 6 different editors.
And that's a really unusual kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I remember you finding it extraordinarily helpful.
It was amazing, which is one of the things that I think non-writers, you get a lot of people saying, oh, did they change your work a lot? And was that really hard? But that is the biggest gift, I think, as a writer, to have great, great editors. invested enough in your book to give you feedback and give you really, really insightful feedback as well is just
I think so too.
Phenomenal.
And I think that there's a part where we're really scared of it. And I know even when I used to go and talk in schools or I'd talk about the process, I'd be really reluctant to show my drafts or to say I had this much input. Whereas, you know, I was talking to year eights yesterday and I literally hold up one of the drafts that has got Aviva's copy at marks all over it to say, you know, I'm a professional writer. This work was published. This is like my 17th draft and this is how much markup there is on it.
It's huge.
Because I think it, it takes away some of that mythology of the genius writer sitting alone in their garret writing perfect words down on a page. That's not how it happens.
Not
at least
at all.
It's not how it happens for normal people.
But I probably in that second structural edit, I added, that was the point at which the novel finally clicked. I don't think it had ever clicked before that. I had never had a strong sense of what it should look like, but suddenly I did. And I think I added close to 20,000 words in about 5 weeks.
It's crazy.
It was, yeah.
But you said that came out.
It was the easiest.
Really easily.
And a lot of that I think is, you know, there's some really, there are some of my favourite scenes are those late edition scenes and whole kind of plot threads as well.
What I think is really useful for people who are listening who might be in the middle of a redraft and who don't have a publisher and an editor on board to take from that is that your book keeps changing. Like, obviously, it's amazing to have 5 international publishers or editors giving you feedback to make those 20,000 word changes at the end. But if you've got readers reading your work, you can
totally
change that process yourself as well.
There was,
right?
You know, 6 years of changes before that. You know,
all leading up to it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in that editing process, you know, all of those years beforehand, nudged it forward, and it improved over time. But, yeah, nothing quite like that tail end process.
Do you think it will be – how do you think it will change next time you're being edited?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I – the second novel that I am working on, I think from the outset I have a much stronger sense of what the book is about, the story that I want to tell, whereas with The Helpline I didn't have that as much. It crystallised late in the piece. So I think that will help throughout the process. I think you never get back that you're only writing for yourself the first time. And that, like, it's kind of hard to explain what a gift that is in itself.
It's such a gift. And I think so many of the writers we've talked to have said that. Like, you only get it once.
Yeah. And even just to be that immersed on one project. Like, I suspect I will never be that immersed on a single project again. I think I'll always have multiple things, which is good, but you know, has its downsides as well.
Are there any words you're going to avoid next time around, Catherine?
That's what I was going to ask you. Do you know your words?
Actions, I do. I know.
Shrugging?
And, you know, the old she turned and walked away.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of a...
In literary fiction in particular, I had Aviva colour-coded my words and told me exactly how many of them, my repeated words, I do. And now I do have, I think I've got this, like, little zing that occurs in my head when I do the same word in a chapter or a couple of lines away from each other. So I'm more switched onto it, or I can see it better
now. Definitely am.
That does not
aware.
Mean that I can see it necessarily when I'm writing it.
I think the things I liked, I do love someone aggressively, and I don't use the word aggressively, but someone squeezing someone's arm or shoulder
in
a semi-aggressive. Yeah, I love that as an action where someone like just hold someone's shoulder semi-nicely and then squeezes really hard.
Oh, this is saying something about Catherine's inner world.
And the other one I like way too much is when people are uncomfortable in a chair. Like, ooh, the chair is uncomfortable, but really, really they're uncomfortable in the situation.
They totally are. We are not uncomfortable in our chairs right here, right now.
Are you going to give away any of your words, Kate?
I'm really trying to remember them right now. I think that I do a lot of little. I use little so much. Why do I use that so much? And I used a lot of modifiers in Skylarking, perhaps, and I tried to say that that was because that was the voice of the young protagonist who was finding her way in the world, but you know, maybe that's just because I really liked using them.
All right. That's editing. Let's get on with the show.
Let's do it.
This is a Fast and Furious episode with Graham Simsion, who talks about what happens when Bill Gates tweets about your book, writing chick lit, and why social media is a complete waste of time. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming Melbourne-based novelist and screenwriter Graham Simsion to The First Time. Graham's first novel, The Rosie Project, won the 2012 Victorian Premier's Unpublished Manuscript Award, the 2014 ABA Book of the Year, and has sold over 3 million copies worldwide. The sequel, The Rosie Effect, is also a bestseller. Graham's latest novel is Two Steps Forward, which was co-written with his wife, Anne Buist. Welcome, Graham.
Nice to talk to you, Catherine.
Okay, so we're going to start off by talking a little bit about the first time you got published. Your novel, The Rosie Project, started life as a screenplay. Can you tell us how and why you started writing it?
Well, first of all, I started screenwriting because I didn't think I could write a novel. I thought a screenplay would be easier than a novel, which is true, by the way, because a novel is a complete work, whereas a screenplay is one part of a collaboration where there'll be all sorts of other players involved. And I thought, you know, I couldn't do a novel, but I could do a screenplay. So I enrolled at RMIT in the professional screenwriting program. And going into that course, I felt I had to have a project. I had to have something so that whatever you learned in class, I'm a reasonably experienced adult learner, whatever you learned in class, you'd be thinking about in the context of improving your story. So I worked on The Rosie Project right from day one of what turned out to be 5 years of part-time screenwriting course.
Right.
And whenever I learned something in class, I would pretty much go straight home and try to apply it to the screenplay.
Did people, all people go in with a sort of a concept and a...
No, I would have thought most of them didn't. Knowing that if you're given something in the abstract, it just goes over your head. You try to remember it. You try to remember it at the exam or the assignment or whatever. But if it's there and they say, you know, weather can be important, okay, how can I use the weather in my screenplay?
Yeah,
so I'll go back and start applying that straight away. So I worked on The Rosie Project as a screenplay for around 5 years. And it changed enormously.
But the main character, Don, remained the same throughout?
That was probably the center point was my main character, Don. But to say he remained the same throughout would be a simplification. I tuned that character. I learned to make him more focused, to have a clearer mission and so forth. He was a bit wet, I guess, to start with. I made him a lot more decisive, a lot more focused, just as I learned what would make a strong protagonist.
And how did the screenplay then become a novel?
Well, the screenplay became a novel because nobody wanted to make the screenplay. And what I should have told myself before I even thought about getting into screenwriting was who's going to produce a screenplay, an original screenplay from an unknown writer? And the answer is forget it, pretty much. You have to be incredibly lucky. So what everybody's doing today is adapting best-selling novels because the risk assessment has already been done for them. There's a market out there. The bums ready to go on seats have already read the novel and liked it, whether or not that novel was predicted to go great places or not. So I decided at that point to rewrite it as a novel, and I felt that I now knew a lot more about writing a novel because I knew about story, about dialogue, about character. Obviously, I needed to get the prose right, but that was incrementally not such a big deal than if I'd started 5 years earlier and straight into the novel.
And so how long did that process take of converting one to the other?
Okay, I've got a lot of stick for this. The answer is essentially 3 weeks for a first draft, 4 weeks to edit, and that was the version that won the Premier's Literary Award for an Unpublished Manuscript.
Right.
And then, of course, before publication, I had the expert editors at Text, Alison Arnold was my editor, do a lot of work on it, or do work on it. But I've said it now, and it got me a bit of stick in the literary community of, well, it was just dashed off in a few weeks. It obviously can't be of quality. But I would say it took me the 7 weeks plus the 5 years.
Yes. So you had spent 7 weeks converting the screenplay to a manuscript. And at that point, did you send it to the unpublished?
No. At that point... Well, I did eventually, but I didn't know about the Unpublished Manuscript Award, so I wasn't working to a deadline or anything like that. At that point, I, in my naivety, popped it off to two slush piles, to two publishers who accepted unsolicited contributions. Then had Alison Arnold from Text came and spoke to our class and said she would take contributions. So I went straight home, formatted my manuscript into the correct form and the appropriate covering letters, and it was back on her desk that afternoon. She'd gone home, but it was lodged in there. So it was in with three publishers at that point. And then I saw that the unpublished manuscript award was happening. And again, RMIT alerted me to that. So that was one of the great things about being in a course, that you're aware of what's going on around you. So I put it in for that at that point.
And had you heard back from any of the publishers by the time the shortlist for the unpublished manuscript was announced?
Yes. One of the publishers, you know, never, ever responded to me. No matter what happened, they never responded to me. And it was their loss in a big way, because they could have had the book worldwide rights quite cheaply. But one of their overseas subsidiaries ended up paying a great deal more for just local rights.
Right.
But there you go. But one of them got back to me. It was one of those midnights, you know, half a second after midnight, I put the thing in, so I'd be first on the list. And that morning, opening a business, I'd sent them one or three chapters or whatever. They said, send us the rest of the manuscript. So I was very excited. And the guys at RMIT said, oh, we've done that. It's never happened to us. So I was very optimistic and didn't hear any more. So the next thing I heard, and the big moment for me, the biggest moment in my writing career, without a doubt, was when I got a telephone call from the Wheeler Centre, who were looking after the Premier's Literary Award, as I had been shortlisted. And a few years ago, Helen Garner talked about the pain, the agony of being shortlisted and not winning. Well, for me, it was quite different. Just getting on the shortlist was this tremendously important validation for me. And whether or not I won, I felt the door was open now, and that it would go on to publication, that I could write.
And so what was the period of time between they announced the shortlist and then it's a month or a couple of months later that they announced the winner?
Look, if I remember rightly, it was about 3 weeks. It wasn't long.
Okay.
It wasn't long.
And did you know before the announcement was made publicly that you had won?
No, I did not.
Ah.
I was overseas.
Ah.
So I was hanging there on the phone line. Well, I was hanging waiting for the phone call. And when the time went by and my representative hadn't called me, I thought, well, we haven't got it. But then she phoned because she'd been given the acceptance speech on my behalf.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was sort of a great, it was a really good moment. But as I say, the really big moment was being shortlisted. And at that point, I wrote off to the publishers who I'd sent it to. Another publisher came on board and wanted to read. And finally, when I actually won the award, one of the publishers, in fact, the one who'd asked for three chapters and then passed, then came in and had another look at it and made an offer.
And so you managed, so you had multiple offers. It went to multiple publishers after the manuscript competition and you had multiple.
I think it ended up with five publishers, I think, would have seen it.
Yeah.
One didn't respond, one passed, and three made offers.
Yeah, and you managed that process yourself?
Yep.
You didn't think, I'll get an agent, or I know a lot of people who have...
No, I didn't think I'd get an agent, and I wouldn't turn other people off getting an agent, but I think an agent does essentially three things for you. One, they help you find a publisher, and I was on that path already.
Yeah.
Two, they help you manage your career, and
yep.
Look, I'm an older guy, I run a business, I'd actually given seminars on career management, so and counseled a lot of people, so I felt I had that in hand. And thirdly, they help you liaise as an intermediary with your publisher. And I was dealing with a relatively small publisher in the end with text.
Yep.
I'd heard Tony Jordan speak on this, on working without an agent with text specifically. And she'd given me some confidence I could do that. And I'd worked as a business consultant for many years, where I was liaising with people in management roles. So I certainly wasn't intimidated in any way by that.
Yep. And was it a difficult process picking a publisher from those, or you knew text were the right fit?
Right from the beginning, when I'd been to a talk by Tony Jordan and she'd told the story of choosing text or being chosen by text, I'd had a very good feeling about text, but their offer was by far the best. It wasn't the best financially, but it was the best in terms of understanding the book and the marketing resources they promised to put behind it. And in speaking with me about what we would do and listening to what I wanted, I'd said to the publishers, look, I've been shortlisted for the Premier's Literary Award. In the end, I said, I'm going to make a decision on Sunday. This was actually after I won the award. It was about 5 days. I said, I don't want this thing to hang around forever. I'm going to make the decision Sunday and let you all know Monday. So up till Friday, contact me in any way you like and talk. And text were the ones who really took up the offer to talk to me and ask. And from my business background, I knew that was going to be a good thing.
Yeah, interesting. And so once you had signed with text, what was the process from there?
Well, at that point, Text put it out in the international market, and they also began the editing process. And it was a fairly light edit. It didn't change structurally.
And they took it overseas pretty much immediately?
Yeah, that's right.
And they did all the rights negotiations and all those
things? That's right. I actually sold the international rights to Text on the basis they would on-sell them.
Yep, okay. What was the reception that you were getting overseas? Was it an immediate...
Yeah, look, it was sent out in advance of the Frankfurt Book Fair. So texts were expecting potential offers at the Frankfurt Book Fair. But the Germans, a German publishing company, made a preemptive offer prior to the fair within days of it going out, within about 48 hours of it going out. And it was a very substantial offer. And at that point, obviously, other publishers around the world, because they all talk and watch, took notice and read. And we sold all the rights, essentially, prior to the Frankfurt Book Fair over a two-week period.
Wow.
Yeah, there were a few rats and mice after that, but all the big ones went over 2 weeks. It was a very exciting time.
I imagine. So you knew pretty early on it was going to be big, or was there a point in the process?
Oh, a very, very specific point when Michael Hayward from Text phoned me and told me what the German offer was.
Right.
Because, you know, Text's advance had been about 3 days consulting fees for the work I was doing as a freelancer on the side to support myself. So it wasn't anything that was going to change my life. It changed my life in a psychological way, but not financially. And the Germans came in with an offer that I knew that if it was matched in any sort of proportion around the world, would enable me to become a full-time writer. So it was a pretty big day.
And were they all multiple book offers or?
No, they weren't. The majority of them were single book offers.
Yeah.
But I got a 3-book offer from the US. And look, memory fails me now. I think the only multiple book offer was from the US and Australia. I negotiated a 3-book deal with Text.
Okay. What sorts of things were you prepared for when the Rosie Project came?
So if I can just say, one of the attractions for a multi-book deal is that on the signing of the contract, of course, you get an advance. Of course, they don't publish the book, they want it back. But and for people whose cash flow is really tight and so forth, you say, oh, yes, it's money in hand, I'll take that. But I have a real problem with taking money ahead of actually having done the work. I think that's going to put real undue pressure on you.
In terms of when the Rosie Project did finally come out, what sorts of things were you prepared for and what were you not really prepared for?
Look, I think I was largely prepared for most of what happened when it came out because we knew it was going to be pretty big. Now, that's not true. We had an expectation that it would be pretty big. Nothing is guaranteed. But there was a lot of hype and buzz around it, you know, interviews and all that. So we thought there would be some attention. I knew I'd have to do interviews. I knew I'd have to do book events and so on. So I was broadly prepared for that. I'll tell you what I wasn't prepared for. I wasn't prepared for how gendered the book market is. I had no idea that the majority, as we're told by publishers now, of fiction readers are women. So it hit me in a couple of places, but one was about the second or third event I did. There'd only been women at the events, but they'd been small. And then I had an event in Sydney and there were 91 people there.
Right.
Of whom one was male, was a guy I'd invited myself. And up till then, I must have had 130, 140 people who'd been at events, all female bar this guy. And that plays into all sorts of things. It plays into covers for the book. I was astounded to see publishers proposing chick lit type covers, you know, the girl in the little skirt and the bubbly champagne glass in her hand. I think, what sort of bloke's going to pick up a book like that? And the answer was, we're not trying to sell the blokes. We're only trying to sell the women.
Interesting.
And I found that, and I pushed back very, very hard on it. And all except one country I was able to push back on the covers. One country was the USA, and they went with a big red book with a heart on the front. And, you know, one of my big supporters in the US readers has been Bill Gates. And, you know, he's sitting there with this book, which is just so schmaltzy romance looking. I went to something else with a paperback, but it was a chick lit style of book. So that and even.
So probably not when you were writing it, but if you had thought about your audience, what kind of an audience had you envisaged?
People. I mean, that sounds really, really silly.
Yeah.
But that's actually who have read the book.
Yeah.
The real audience is, it's a book. The Rosie Project is a book that people of all ages seem to like. It's a love story. But you know what? Men fall in love as well as women. Young people, old people fall in love. And I have lots of male readers. I have young readers and I have old readers. But the publishers continue to think it's a female market. Look, if you did all numbers, you might well find that. But I've seen some really dumb things done by publishers around this absolute fixation on women's fiction. In fact, editor said to me just a few days ago, she said, all fiction is women's fiction. And wasn't meaning like that it should be suitable for women, because she wouldn't have said all fiction is men's fiction.
Yeah, that's interesting. So do you think about that in writing subsequent novels?
I try not to, but my editors make sure I do. The number of sentences I've read that start off, our female readers, and what they're asking for is dumbed down versions, particularly in the context of romance or sex. They're looking for a stereotypical view of the male as being without fault, as being, you know, Darcy.
Right. Yeah.
They want Darcy as the male and a very thin sort of, you know, thinly drawn sort of Darcy. And they would like the women to be just a little drab because that's the fantasy, of course.
Right.
You're in the, yeah. And look, I don't say the fantasy for all women readers, obviously not. But they're targeting a sort of a particular type of female reader who reads chick lit. And my, if you write a book which is about relationships, which is written in an accessible style and perhaps has a bit of humour, that's called chick lit. And I mean, it's a massive problem for me in terms of the marketing of such a book. It was a huge problem with The Best of Adam Sharp.
Right.
Because I think it's a book that men find more attractive than women. There's a lot of stuff going on in a male head that I have, you know, that my editors were saying, women don't want to read about that stuff. They don't want him thinking like that. I said, well, they do. Men do. Yes, but we don't know about it. Our readers don't want to.
So do you think things would be different if Adam Sharp had been your first novel?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been published.
Right, okay.
Well, no, I'd like to think it would have been published.
Yeah.
But by having the Rosie Project, the Rosie Effect out there, both of which sold substantial numbers, I was virtually guaranteed that whatever I wrote would be published. But I think Adam Sharp might have been picked up with much lower expectations. So I wouldn't be trying to follow a million seller. I'd be, you know, getting out there and saying, well, first book and it sold, you know, 10,000 copies. Good work in Australia. We'll go from there.
Yeah,
and the problem there too was that having the first, one of the lessons I learned, because you asked me what I learned and what I wish people had told me, was that you get, if you're writing popular fiction or I'd like to say quality contemporary fiction, but not stuff that is particularly literary fiction with a capital L, then you are expected to stick to your genre and ideally to your series. In the old days, I think people would follow an author no matter what they wrote. Now they're saying your first book, Graham, was romantic comedy. Our expectation is so strong that everything else will be romantic comedy that we will read. The number of reviews I've read of both The Rosie Effect and Best of Adam Sharp, neither of which are by any stretch of the imagination romantic comedies, where they have just called them romantic comedies because The Rosie Project was one,
yeah,
and then evaluated with them with that hat on, has been quite astounding.
Right. So will that shape future novels, or you just...
I write what I want to.
You write what you want, and you're in a good position to be able to do that.
Look, I'm in a reasonable position. I don't think that there's any serious... Look, putting text aside, I think loyalty from publishers is not what it once was. They're not signing authors, they are signing books. I've had three publishers now in the US, and by the time I get to the new Rosie book, I'll probably have had four.
Okay, we might move on to the business of writing.
Okay, let me stop you right there.
Yep.
I don't think it's a business.
Right, okay.
I think it's a really wrong term to use. I think if you're self-publishing and you're doing everything yourself, call it a business. But if you are somebody working with a mainstream publisher, then I would call it a profession. And there is a difference. You are not, you're the business person sitting around wondering about profits and money and all those sorts of things. I think you are a professional artist.
Yep.
Rather than a business person. I think it's a mistake
right,
to see yourself as a business
profession.
Person.
So, you know, writing is one thing, but there is a move towards, or there is a need for promotions and doing activities that sit alongside writing to sell books.
So the publishers will tell you.
Well, I'm interested to hear your take on it. Do you think that sells books?
Certainly there is a need for all of those, for sales activities and promotional activities, and the publishers have their own resources for that. The question is, what is the role of the author in those? And look, I've come out of a marketing... You know, I ran a business for many, many years. So I'm not naive in this context, but I think the publishing industry often is. I think the publishing industry runs to a model which is increasingly dated and is now under review. It's things like author tours and so forth. And I think that the ability of the individual author to promote the sales of their book is grossly overstated. And you get this sort of thing like for example, the publisher will say, we're going to send you on a book tour. And if you say, well, is that really going to help? Is it really going to sell a lot of books or whatever? They say, well, you don't want to go on a book tour. You're not rewarding out. You're not keen to help with the book. So therefore, you don't have faith. Or if you don't have faith in us, we won't have faith in you is the dynamic of what's going on there without anybody saying hard, why are we doing this? And my experience would be that book tours, for example, don't sell books. They are largely used, in my experience, by publishers to maintain relationships with independent bookstores who they are afraid will disappear. You've got these traditions, if you like. So if you look at something like a book tour, the publishers say, look, we've organized this fantastic book tour for you. And if you push back and say, well, do you think it'll sell a lot of books? What's the purpose of the tour? And so on, because they cost a lot of money. you're traveling around the States, you're flying in planes everywhere, you're having escorts take you to the shops and that sort of thing, and you walk into a Barnes & Noble and there'll be three books on the counter that they've just left for you, not even talking to anyone, to sign, and you've driven 25 miles to do it.
Right.
You say, why are we doing this?
Oh, so you're not talking about ones where people are attending?
Oh, there's different sorts. That,
right.
So you'll have attendances.
Yep.
Attendances of book events. They might be three people.
Yeah.
That would not be unusual. So you say, why am I flying here, paying for this motel or whatever? You know, they're paying for the motel. I'm going to get three people along and sell two books. Or we get 100 people and sell 30 books. It's a real drop in the ocean. Why are we doing this? And if you push back with that, you're likely that the publisher will say, well, don't you want to do the book tour? We are showing our faith in you. Aren't you interested in contributing? And it's seen as almost a moral failing, as a lack of interest. It's taken on that soft view rather than a hard question, is this doing any good? So a lot of things I think that authors are asked to do are in that sort of chicken soup view. Can't do any harm, might do some good. And that's, you know, answering questions on blogs, social media, almost a complete waste of time for most authors.
So what do you think, what would be the best way of selling books?
Write a better book. And I'm deadly serious about this.
Right.
You're sitting there on Twitter, or you're sitting there writing a whole bunch of answers to a blog or something like that. You could be, this is not a zero cost thing. You could be writing the next book. And ultimately, what sells books is word of mouth. And publishers will say that too. I mean, look, you could have some extraordinary marketing campaign that comes out of nowhere. You could be an author who's famous in their own right. Yeah, you're President Clinton and you co-author a book. Sure, with James Patterson, that's going to have a lot of interest straight away, but you're not President Clinton and nor am I. And as a regular author, unless you've got some special point of difference that's really stand out, then my take is the best thing you can do is write a better book, because that's what will keep the word of mouth going. The difference between, you know, four stars, 4.5 stars on Goodreads, that's going to make a bigger difference. That's what people think of the book. Then any number of book events that you do.
You put your effort and energy just into writing, or you'll do some events and things like
I've
that?
I've done heaps and heaps and heaps of events, partly because I enjoy doing them. And I think that's an important thing. I enjoy doing book events. I do not regard them as a way of boosting my sales. If I have a massive night, and so look, when the Rosie Project was at its peak, it was selling probably a book a minute or a book every 2 minutes around the world.
Wow.
I can't match that. You know, I'm an event for an hour, I sell 30 books. It's just no different. And then if you work it with scale, if you're an author whose book isn't selling as well, you'll get proportionally less people at the events and so on. And for some people, that's an awful lot of work. It's a lot of sweat. It's a lot of lying awake at night. It's not just the 2 hours they spend at the event. It's the day before prepping it and so on, the lost sleep when they could be writing.
Interesting. What about criticism? You know, has the Rosie Project had much in the way of criticism? And if so,
all
how have you coped?
Criticism. And look, if you're a big book and you get three great reviews, what do you think the fourth journalist is going to sit down and write? They're going to jump on board with everybody else. They're going to be different. So I was reading Paul Simon, from Simon & Garfunkel biography recently. And what he said about criticism is an echo. He said, when you start off, you don't want to read the critics because you're worried that you become insecure, you'll be put off and scared by what they say. When you're really established and doing really well, you don't read the critics because who cares? You're doing fine anyway. And finally, when in a mature state, you don't worry about the critics because they get in the way of the process. And I think that's where I am now, that yes, I read. The only reason I read reviews really in the newspaper and so on is I'm looking, searching them for what might be a takeout that can go on the cover of the book. So actually you get a lousy review, but somebody says, Graham has a fantastic sense of humour. Fantastic. That's my line.
Right.
That'll be the one that goes on the book. And obviously your publisher's watching out for that too, but that's what you're looking for.
Okay. What about success? Did the Rosie Project make it harder to write the second book? Or
no, it certainly didn't. It made it easier to write the second book because, again, I look at myself as a professional and I was an experienced professional. The first time is always the hardest, whether it's fixing a car, making a salad, doesn't matter. It's the first time you do it, it takes a lot longer. You're unsure of yourself. The second time, you've got a much better idea if you're a reflective practitioner of what works and what doesn't. It was much easier. People talk about the pressure to do better or as well, and I didn't really feel that. I think that you are going to, over a career, which is what I hope to have, you are going to create a portfolio of work. Some of it's going to be your best work. Some of it won't be as strong and so on. It won't all be in order of better, 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 better. It just isn't it. I feel my craft getting better, but maybe the idea isn't going to be quite as strong. Or maybe that was a year that I was a bit down about something else. But at the end of your career, you want to be able to look back and say, well, you know, there's some big highlights and some of them came early, some of them came late. I'm going to do the very best I can right now. And of course, and this goes with criticism as well, some books will be huge sellers. Some books, well, relatively speaking, will be better sellers. Some books will be better received critically. Some will give you more personal satisfaction.
All right. Now we're going to move to some advice for debut novelists. Graham, my novel, The Helpline, comes out in September this year. As that day approaches, what one piece of advice would you give me or another author?
One piece of advice.
You could give more than one.
All right. The one piece of advice is a bit combined, is get off social media and write the next novel. The single best thing you can be doing is getting another book on the way. And the worst thing you can be doing, I think, is obsessing about these chicken soup ideas of can't do any harm, may do some good. Let me just, you could edit this out if you like.
No, actually, this is really interesting advice because it's a time burglar. Okay. Social media is a complete thief of time.
Absolute thief of time, and publicists and so forth tend to take the chicken soup approach. They can't prove to you that it works, but how can it do any harm? And the way it can do harm is it's robbing your time when you could be writing that better book or writing the book, you know, writing a new book or writing it better. And I've really watched, you know, I've tried to monitor what works and what doesn't. Let me say what works in terms of boosting sales is broadcast media. If you can get on radio or TV, you travel, you missed your New Year's Eve celebrations in your London hotel, which we did to go up to Manchester to be on BBC breakfast show. And that morning the book comes out and it's at 300 on Amazon. And that afternoon it's at 2, you know, behind Jamie Oliver.
Wow.
Like, whoa. And that's what broadcast media does for you. Twitter?
Yep.
Okay. If somebody had said to me, what would you pay to have someone with 30 million followers tweet about your book? Because I've got 10,000 or something, 30 million followers tweet about your book in a very positive sense, what would that be worth to you? And the answer is almost nothing. Bill Gates tweeted about the Rosie Project, 30 million followers. I've had a number of other players, Alan Carr, the comedian, tweeted about, and you watch Amazon to see if it moves. Doesn't move. Oh, on the other hand, Bill Gates was on television, on cable TV, and mentioned the Rosie Project. Whoop! What happened there? Suddenly it's in the top 20.
Wow, that's a beautiful comparison forms.
Yeah, so social media, even from other people, it says this is a great book. I'm not saying it has no effect whatsoever, but it doesn't have anything like the effect that people think intuitively.
Interesting. Graham, thanks for being with us. Okay, Graham Simpson, this is our first time quick five. Can you tell us, for your first time, agent or no agent?
No agent.
Advance or no advance?
Advance.
Overseas territories or just Australia, New Zealand?
We did 40 overseas territories.
Festival invites or no festival invites?
I think I've done most of the Aussie festivals.
And do you know how many copies of The Rosie Project sold?
About 3.5 million.
And the last final question is, what is your favourite novel by a debut author?
I don't do favourites. A longer answer? Is it Madame Bovary? How do you compare Madame Bovary with One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich or Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, The Rosie Project? I don't think it's useful to make that comparison.
Yeah, okay. All right. We'll go with that.
You can check out the show notes for this episode with Graham Simpson on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. You'll find links and more info there. And please let us know about your first time or any of the questions that you want answered that we haven't asked yet. Hit us up on Twitter or Instagram at thefirsttimepod. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, and RMIT School of Media and Communication.